Welcome to Healthcare Unfiltered. I am your host, Shadi Nabhan. I'm a hematologist and a medical oncologist with interest in all aspects of healthcare delivery, treatment, leadership, mentorship, and policy. Today's podcast is about clinical advances, and we are going to talk about one of the most challenging cancers a medical oncologist or a neuro-oncologist could ever face: brain cancers, brain tumors, especially primary brain tumors, and specifically the glioblastoma multiforme. These are the aggressive brain tumors that we usually face and for which treatment options are rather limited. Today's podcast is with Dr. Manmeet Ahluwalia, Chief of Medical Oncology at Miami Cancer Institute, Chief Scientific Officer and Deputy Cancer Center Director. Manmeet is an amazing, inspiring individual who has unparalleled passion to research in general and to research in brain tumors in particular. I asked him to come on the show, A, to share with us a little bit about his career, what got him into neuro-oncology. It is not the type of field that someone really easily would do, because unfortunately, we lose more than we win in this disease. And in medical oncology, we always want to try to win to help all patients with cancer. I also wanted to know from him, as do we know what causes these brain tumors? What can we do about them? And what is the future looking like? This is really an important podcast about an awful disease, and I hope that you are going to share with me the enthusiasm that I left this podcast after. After taping this podcast, Dr. Manmeet Ahluwalia energized me because he is optimistic that the future is bright, and hopefully we are going to know more about this disease and how we treat it. Before I air this podcast that I taped with Dr. Manmeet Ahluwalia towards the end of 2023, I ask you to subscribe to the show, rate it, and write a brief review. Share it with your friends and colleagues, and you can watch it on my website, shadinabhan.com, or on my YouTube channel, Shadi Nabhan and Healthcare Unfiltered. Let me know what you think by direct messaging me on Twitter at Shadi Nabhan. And if you're looking to read a book, how in the world could you not read Toxic Exposure, The True Story Behind the Monsanto Trials and the Search for Justice? Pick it up, read it cover to cover. I promise you won't regret that. Without further ado, Dr. Manmeet Ahluwalia on Healthcare Unfiltered. Okay, folks, Healthcare Unfiltered here with the one and only Dr. Manmeet Ahluwalia, who is appearing on this podcast for the first time, which means, by the way, Manmeet, you've earned a t-shirt. I mean, this is a big deal.
Listen, I'm most honored to be on this highly coveted podcast, and so great to spend time with you.
Get ready to wear the Healthcare Unfiltered t-shirt. And Manmeet, I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but the rumor has it is one of your favorite books is Toxic Exposure, the true story behind the Monsanto trials and the search for justice. So hopefully folks will listen to you and read it. But today's podcast is really a little bit about you and a little bit about the disease that you treat, because there's a lot here to unpack in a short time. I want to start by having you introduce yourself to folks and what got you into neuro-oncology, and the challenges to really establish a research career in neuro-oncology. But let's just start a little bit about you as to who you are, what you do, where you do it, and what inspired you to become a neuro-oncologist.
Sure. So I'm Manmeet Ahluwalia. I'm a medical oncologist. I do serve as the chief of medical oncology, the chief scientific officer, and the deputy director of the Miami Cancer Institute. And I've been here for 3 years. Prior to this, I spent 15 years at Cleveland Clinic, either as a resident or as a staff. I did go away to Roswell Park Cancer Institute for my fellowship training in Buffalo, New York. And my journey in oncology has been, a personal journey. When I was 12, I was actually living with my grandmother who died of cancer. And as a young, naive kid, I wanted to come to US and cure cancer. And now I only get humbled. So I did know that I wanted to go into oncology, but I did not know that I would go into neuro-oncology. And it was only at Cleveland Clinic when I was doing my residency, I got to rotate on the oncology service with David Pierboom, who's a neuro-oncologist. And I got to write a trial with him. And that really got me interested in the field. And Derek Raghavan, who used to be the cancer center director there, was the first person to tell me that I should go and pursue a career in neuro-oncology, because he said the field can use someone like you with a lot of energy and drive. I initially told him no, but then over a course of time, I was able to work with Dr. Laszlo Mechler as a fellow. But because I had done a fair amount of work in residency in neuro-oncology, I knew more than the other oncology fellows. So whenever there was a quiz or a paper, I knew about it. So that just prompted, it was the virtuous circle. It's like what you do well in life, you tend to do more. And then I ended up becoming a neuro-oncologist, and Derek Raghavan re-recruited me to Cleveland Clinic as a faculty in 2009 to develop a clinical trials program there. And I was very fortunate to work with some of the very best people in the world.
How difficult is to develop, and how do you even develop a clinical trial program? I mean, so you, it's an honor to be recruited to do something like this. And so he said, okay, go ahead and develop a clinical trial program for brain tumors. What do you do? Like, who do you call? Do they give you money? Do you call pharma? Do you call the NCI? Like, how do you even start?
Yeah, so before we go there, you know, of the most physicians who take care of patients with brain tumors, 90% of them tend to be neurology in pedigree. So they are neurology residents who do a 1 to 2 year fellowship in neuro-oncology. Only 10% or so are medical oncologists like me, who do a medical oncology fellowship and then do brain tumors. And I personally am biased. I'm a medical oncologist like you. And I think you have a little bit more connections with pharma because, you know, through your trainings, you're doing trials in lung cancer, breast cancer, GI, GU, and you tend to formulate a little bit more connections, if I may use that term. So when I got to Cleveland Clinic, I had worked on a number of trials with my mentors or my faculty at Roswell, which made me have those connections. And I reached out to them, and like just everyone else, you know, when you're young in your career, you have to put like 10 concepts for one approval, right? Later on in your career, you've made your, track record. People know you. You can be a little bit more selective. So I put in so many concepts I can't even remember. And luckily, we got to run a trial with duvitinib, which was an FGFR inhibitor along with the VEGF inhibitor. And it was a drug, you know, made by Novartis, and we ran the trial. Also, I was lucky to go to Vale Clinical Trials Workshop. So if there are any fellows listening to this podcast or junior faculty, if you've not gone to Vail, please try your best to go to Vail. It's the best clinical trials workshop you have, at least in United States. And I was so lucky. I ran into so many marquee key opinion leaders there, and that led to a lot of personal relationships. But more importantly, when I got out of that workshop a week later, I really was confident that I could write trials in a very robust manner. And so I think that was one of the good opportunities for me. And we also had a pretty large program at Cleveland Clinic. My chairman, Gene Barnett, was extremely supportive, along with Derek Raghavan, who was the Cancer Center Director. We had good number of research nurses, independent just for brain tumors. And that's also a big aspect. If you're looking at a job, look at what are the resources you're going to do or get, rather. So if someone says you've got to go and develop a clinical trials program, there are so many aspects that go into it, right? Do you have a mentor? Do you have a mentor in the field? Or do you have a mentor even outside the field? Sometimes the principles of clinical trial writing, they're no different for lung cancer compared to brain tumors, right? You just have to have the thought process. And then the other aspect is the soft resources. Like, are there enough research nurses? Do you have someone who can help you with the protocol writing? Is there someone who can help you with the budget? All these things are important, and I was fortunate we had that at Cleveland Clinic, including amazing group of senior colleagues and research nurses who helped me along the path. So one trial left to the other. And when I left Cleveland Clinic, I can say this proudly because we don't have had a lot of success in our field, but I had 7 open investigator-initiated trials running at that time point, and with 2 more about to open. And that really was a culmination of a decade or more worth of work of the team as a whole and having some amazing mentorship that I was very fortunate to get over the years.
I think it's fair to say that there are the inherent challenges of getting funding and opening clinical trials in cancer research overall. Are there specific challenges that you found that are more specific for brain cancers or neuro-oncology that may not necessarily apply to folks who are doing GI or GU oncology that are makes it either less challenging or more challenging?
No, it is. To be honest with you, you know, most companies don't want to go into drug development in brain tumors. It's not a well-kept secret, right? As Ron DiPinio had said, glioblastoma is a graveyard for drug development. So it just made us more determined. And so clearly, whenever, even when I remember, you know, nivolumab and ipilimumab was being developed, and, you know, I was in a high-level meeting with the BMS folks, and they showed us some of their priority list. GBM was not in top 10. But over the period of time, they did do three large trials with nivolumab when they got some approvals. So clearly, unless a drug, and there are not many of them, have been specifically developed with an intent to have blood-brain barrier penetration with a target that's relevant in the brain, companies don't primarily look towards GBM as their top one, two, or three priorities. So we just have to be our own advocate for our patients and just continue to put in concepts relentlessly. And the other thing I would say is what helped me was I was part of cooperative groups. So I was part of NRG Oncology for 15 years. I also now serve as the chair of the CNS working group for SWOG. So I was lucky to have been part of the cooperative groups where, you know, we at least have our own discipline and some concepts go through. Although anyone who has worked through cooperative group know that persistence is the number one quality you need if you want to successfully navigate the cooperative group process. But that helped me. It helped me get some resources. It helped made connections for me. And sometimes we would talk to companies and they would say, you know what, we don't want to do a large cooperative group trial, but we may do a small investigator initiated trial. And for us, no trial was small enough. We got what we could. And as we did some, we were able to create a track record. And then next time, as you know, then the companies know who are the six or eight key opinion leaders they typically gravitate to. And the question is, right, how do you position yourself as one of those?
How do you split your time? I mean, you have to you have an administrative role as the CSO and the deputy director of the cancer center. You take care of patients. You are doing clinical research, a variety of clinical research, and you also have a family. So how are you able to to do all of this without losing your mind?
You know, so one of the things that really helped me was when I did my executive MBA, which because, you know, in academic medicine, all of us are very ingrained and we sometimes become like one domain. And that's important because that helps you get through medical school, make all the sacrifices all of us make at the prime of our life, right? Doing those 80-hour calls. And it's all like, I can do it. MBA, on the other hand, made me think not in I, but in we terms, so doing things as a team, but also understanding, as you alluded to, everything is important in life. So family, community, your professional academic career. So I really, those are the ways how I think how to divvy up my time. Clearly, when I took on this role as the chief of medical oncology and the chief scientific officer, I knew that I had to cut down on my clinical trials research personally. So like I said, when I joined this place, I had nine of such trials at Cleveland Clinic, seven open and running, two in the process of opening up. Now, I only have one investigator-initiated trial open right now and one in the process of opening. So from like nine, I've come down to two. So that has created opportunities. At Cleveland Clinic, I used to see patients 1.5 days in clinic. Now I see patients half day in clinic. But a lot of my other time, I used to mentor my faculty. I have around 28 medical oncologists to report up to me in my role. And a key component of my job now is to mentor my faculty in them getting their investigator-initiated trials. And I can proudly say in the last 2 years, I've helped five of them get their investigator-initiated trials. And for several of them, it was their first. And only one of them was in brain tumors. Others were in breast cancer, prostate cancer, even CNS lymphoma. So I think that's a big part. And then obviously the other part goes into administration of actually making sure that the clinical trials office is running on time and is catering to the needs of the 120 physicians we have in the cancer center. So we have around 200 open trials at Miami Cancer Institute. This year, we put around 260 patients on trials, which is almost like a 35% increase from when I took this over 3 years back. And most cancer centers actually have seen a decrease because of a lot of challenges that we've had in clinical research in the academic world.
And we're going to make watching and listening to this podcast as a mandatory onboarding process at Miami Cancer Institute. We'll send you the link when it's out. Manmeet, I want to try to segue from this into some of the advances in brain tumors. But I want to start by, do we know more about the pathobiology? Do we understand more why some people develop brain cancers or not? There's a lot sometimes in the press, literally, I mean, you can Google, and you see some even press about cell phones, about cell towers, about whatever it is. And some people will swear that this caused brain tumors, and some people will say, no way, it's BS. So I guess my first question to you is, do we know why brain cancers develop, or is it just unfortunately unlucky? Do we understand anything in terms of causation, pathobiology, anything you can share with us, or all of this still under investigation?
So what I would say is I'm going to use glioblastoma, which is the prototype of primary brain tumors. Of all the 100 patients we see, only 1% have genetic syndromes, right? Which like Lynch syndrome or Lee-Fromany and other syndromes which may lead to a brain tumor. For the 99%, sadly, it's stroke of bad luck. And we don't fully understand what causes it. Now, as you alluded to very eloquently, in the last decade or so, there has been a lot of interest in cell phone usage and whether that has led to increase in brain tumors. And what I would say is systematic studies, and most of them come from Scandinavia, like everything else in medicine, have not shown any direct correlation. That being said, we do know that if you keep a cell phone close to your, if you're directly talking on your cell phone, that there's an increase in the physiologic activity in the brain. So I try to frankly keep my cell phone away, use speaker as much as I can. I do tend to use Bluetooth, wireless, but then also that has a small risk.
But it's a habit more than because you think it causes brain cancer, or
No, you don't. I don't know. Okay. And over a period of time, this has become just a habit because, you know, like everyone else, I was worried, right? It's not like you want to find out something 20 to 25 years later. But for full disclosure, in terms of evidence-based medicine, there has been no study which has very clearly, unequivocally shown that there is an increase in brain tumors coming from cell phone usage. But what I would always say to people is make sure that you can minimize the cell phone usage for at least kids, because their skull is still thin and it's developing and they have a much longer age frame. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one thing I would say just to people, that, you know, cell phone usage per se of kids should be minimized, because we do know too much of electronic exposure is not good for the brain development, overall personality development of kids. But that's the world we live in. We are connected, and a cell phone is one of the most important things that we own in life. I mean, you know, you almost feel like you're not part of the world if you don't, you know, use your cell phone for any hour almost.
So, I mean, in summary, we really don't know why it happens. I mean,
Summary, no. Unfortunately, the only other interesting thing that we know is allergy is a protectant. So people who have allergies have a lower incidence of brain tumors, and we don't fully understand that. And also, what I did not add is prior radiation exposure is a risk for brain tumors. But that's, we do know radiation can be mutagenic with time, right? So if people have had, say, radiation for meningioma early in the life, they can get theoretically secondary brain tumors from radiation.
Okay, now moving on into, you know, we don't know really why these things happen. I mean, but they happen. So when they happen, how often do they happen in a way that a competent surgeon could actually remove the tumor?
Yeah, so, you know, overall, there are around 12 to 14,000 glioblastoma diagnoses in the United States every year. So luckily, it is not very common, but it is common enough. And 70% of the care is still given in the community. It's not given at academic centers or comprehensive cancer centers. So that's also a reality. But if you do have a glioblastoma, I think it's better to get operated on by a neurosurgeon who just does brain tumor surgery and does not do spine surgery, because you have a better chance of removing the tumor as much as the surgeon can. So the dogma, though, is maximal possible safe resection. And what I mean by that is, and that's why the term glioblastoma multiforme used to be used previously, that these tumors actually spread like spider webs. So they have extended beyond where you see the contrast on the MRI, which is, you know, a sad state of affairs. So what a surgeon tries to do is remove as much as he can safely of something that is enhancing on the MRI. But we do know the tumors spread beyond that. So no matter how good of a surgery you've had with glioblastoma, everyone gets 6 weeks of radiation if they're in good condition and less than 70 years of age, along with a chemotherapy called temozolomide, which is an alkylating agent for 6 weeks, followed by six cycles of temozolomide. And that is a standard of care treatment for glioblastoma. There is a medical device called tumor treating fields, which is arrays that you keep on people's head that delivers electric fields that are shown to increase progression-free survival and overall survival, but has not gotten the kind of uptick you would expect. Only around 10 to 15% of the patients in the country use it, because you have to shave your hair off every 48 hours, every 2 days, 3 days, and wear these arrays 18 hours a day. So it's fairly cumbersome. But to answer your question, surgery is the beginning block, but they need radiation and chemo.
It seems that, you know, you do the surgery, which it takes time to recover. I mean, this is not like an easy surgery. I'm presuming 4 to 6 weeks to recover from brain surgery. And then you have to do the chemotherapy and the radiation. With all of this, I mean, a median survival of 12 to 15 months, it's awful. I mean, if you just do the surgery and you don't do chemo and radiation, what's the median survival? I mean, how much incremental benefit are we really giving patients?
Yeah, great point. So if a surgeon can only do a biopsy, so not a complete surgery, those patients sadly live 3 months. This is a bad disease. Right. If you only do surgery and not do anything else, the average survival is around 6 months.
I see.
If you add radiation to that, you kind of extend that survival to around 12 months. If you add chemotherapy, temozolomide, you extend it to 15 months. So this is the block, 3, 6, 12,
okay.
15.
Good quality of life. I mean, in the patients that you care for, do you feel they're functioning, doing okay?
So you know, obviously, it's a discussion with the patient and the family. But for the patients who have a good performance status, say an ECOG of 0, 1, even 2, if we give them radiation and chemotherapy, the general quality of life is good, pretty much till the end. Because one of the saving graces of glioblastoma is that these patients typically will not have any pain or some of the other challenges of cancer. It's just that they, over a period of time, will become weaker and their functional status will decrease, which typically happens in the last 3 months for most patients.
So is there any other drug than temozolomide that you're excited about in these brain tumors? Are there any targets? I mean, we hear a lot about, I mean, lung cancer is just right now, there's like 25 types of lung cancer. At this point, you can't even say non-small cell lung cancer or small cell lung cancer. You have to see what's the driver mutation. Have you guys been able to find the driver mutations, driver biomarkers, where you could say, okay, let's check for this because there's a drug for that. Are we there or not yet?
So again, you know, we do know that genomic profiling has truly transformed cancer care in the last two decades, and will continue to add more targets and hopefully better drugs. So in glioblastoma, EGFR, just like lung cancer you alluded to, is expressed in around 50% of our patients. But so far, all the small molecule inhibitors antibody drug conjugates have all been negative, even the early bispecifics. The only target that has seemed to have worked so far reasonably well in glioblastoma in terms of genomics or precision oncology has been gene fusions. So we know that there are two drugs approved for NTRK gene fusions, you know, which is a pan-agnostic, pan-tumor or tumor-agnostic approval for larotrectinib and entrectinib. And larotrectinib, for example, produces a 30% response rates in patients with primary gliomas, which is favorable compared to 5% that we get with cytotoxic chemotherapies. Other than temozolomide, there is no drug that has even shown us one-day survival benefit in glioblastoma, and that's the sad state of affairs for our patient. We have been excited about gene fusions because I feel they are very durable targets, and we've had trials with some early molecules showing, Ragnar trial, for example, presented at ASCO last year, 20%, 21% response rate. We are leading, I'm involved as a steering committee chair of a drug called pemigatinib, which is ongoing right now, again, an FGFR inhibitor. FGFR tag gene fusions occur in around 3 to 3.5% patients with glioblastoma, so not very common, sadly. And NTRK is only 1%. So you have to, first of all, recognize the target and then give the right drug. So
and if you if you have the target, though, if you have the NTRK, if you're in the lucky 1% and you give the NTRK fusion inhibitor, what's the response and the outcome?
So the response rates per se for gliomas is around 30%, and the progression-free survival's around 6 to 9 months, which is favorable compared to 2 months you'll get with chemo.
Yeah.
So generally, when we have looked at NTRK gene fusion drugs, if you look at all tumors, now their outcomes are 4 to 5 years. And if you gave them chemo, it's only a year. So I think these drugs are shaping how we treat patients. But it's just that in brain tumors, the response rate is only 30% with larotrectinib. It's 80% otherwise. So it's not the same for, say, a lung cancer.
And it's also not that common. I mean, it's 1%.
Yeah,
my gosh.
1%.
Oh, okay. We hear a lot about Avastin in brain tumors. Help us understand, is there a role for Avastin in standard of care? Is being studied, not studied? But it's kind of a little bit all over the place. We do hear about Avastin bevacizumab in brain tumors.
Yeah, so as you know, bevacizumab got accelerated approval in glioblastoma in 2009, which was based on response rates of close to 30%. But they were honestly artificial. And what I mean by that is the way we recognize a glioblastoma is when there is contrast that gets into the tumor on an MRI. And the way the contrast gets into the tumor on an MRI is because there's a breakdown of blood-brain barrier, because an intact, normal human being will not have contrast. And Avastin or bevacizumab is anti-VEGF, which is a permeability factor. So what it does is it actually reseals the blood-brain barrier. So the scan actually starts looking better the very next day or even 48 hours. And we've had some studies where we have showcased that. And it's glioblastoma. No lymphoma, which you know better than me, that it's going to melt away. Okay, so this response rates were artificial. When the final trials were done for survival, none of the 15 or so studies that have been done with Avastin and brain tumors have even shown one-day survival benefit.
Wow!
But because there was such a dearth of therapies in glioblastoma, and Avastin can act as a super steroid, because what it does is it decreases the need for steroids so people can have a good quality of life. FDA gave full approval to Avastin, but it does not improve survival. And we tend to use it, but we tend to use it as a last ditch effort. When I have no other therapies or my patients are needing 6-8 milligrams of dexamethasone for a long period of time where they're, you know, muscles will melt away if I put them on steroids for a long time, I tend to use Avastin. The other reason we don't tend to use Avastin also is because when Avastin fails, almost no therapy works. These people's average survival post-Avastin failure is only around 3 months, and a lot of clinical trials will exclude patients who've been treated with Avastin. So over a period of time now, Avastin, which was almost given to every glioblastoma patient, is given still in selective cases, but more in recurrent setting.
Do we know why the tumors become more resistant after Avastin? That's my number one question. And then my second question, have Avastin been combined with Temodar since, I mean, there's some activity and Temodar is active and in terms of treatment?
Yeah, so first of all, we think when we give patients Avastin, there are other anti-angiogenic pathways which actually get activated just like an oncology general. Some of them are redundant. But then second, also, we do know that there's a mesenchymal phenotype that actually comes out. So it's like the EMT transition that happens and which kind of leads to this. And because of that, we've even given low-dose Avastin, but those trials have really not panned out. Now, to answer your question about Avastin combination with temozolomide, we actually did two large trials for that. One was called the Everglio trial, which was sponsored by Roche. And then we had the RTOG 825 study, which was a cooperative group trial. And none of the trials showed any survival benefit with Avastin added to temozolomide for upfront glioblastoma. So sadly, trials were negative.
Wow. I don't know. Basically, when someone gets surgery, chemo, radiotherapy, Temodar and radiation therapy, and things don't work out, is it hospice, unfortunately, at the time of recurrence or a clinical? What studies? Give us some hope, Manmeet. Give us some hope.
Yeah, so there is hope. So first of all, I will tackle immunotherapy. So there was a lot of interest, as you know, in immunotherapy in brain tumors because immunotherapy was transforming melanoma, non-small cell lung cancer, number of other cancers. So three large immune checkpoint blockade studies in glioblastoma sadly have been negative again. The CheckMate 143 in recurrent glioblastoma compared to Avastin negative. Upfront trials, both in methylated and unmethylated patients have all been negative. I have worked with a vaccine myself for full disclosure. I do have an equity interest in a company called Mimivax. We did trial with a peptide-based vaccine that targets survivin. In a phase two trial, we showed there was a survival benefit compared to historical controls. We saw overall survival of 26 months, which favorably compared to historical controls of close to 16 months. And there's a large phase two randomized trial ongoing around 20 cancer centers across the United States. All the major cancer centers are participating. And the enrollment is actually ahead of the schedule. And the reason for that is, according to the NCCN guidelines, still the first preferred way to treat a patient with glioblastoma is on a clinical trial, which is even highly rated compared to standard of care. So we are giving patients standard of care, chemotherapy, radiation, temozolomide, and then they're getting vaccine on top. So that's the trial. Now, if sadly, despite all standard of care, 6 to 9 months later, most of the glioblastoma patients will have a recurrence. And at that time point, what we try to do these days is if we can safely do surgery, we do surgery and we send the tissue for, profiling. Obviously, you know a thing or two about profiling. And so we try to get maximum information back. And that's where we try to understand, is there a driver, like a, you know, NTRK gene fusion, albeit small numbers, or FGFR TAC gene fusion, 3.5%, for example, for FGFR TAC. And so we can always try to give them on-label or off-label therapy if it'll be allowed. Or we offer patient a clinical trial. And all of us have clinical trials. One important thing to understand is when I say no drug has shown a survival benefit, we mean that generically. That means the trial failed to meet its primary endpoint. That doesn't truly mean that maybe a subset of patients did get a benefit. So a clinical trial will give us hope. It gives patients and their families hope. It's the right thing to do. It's the NCCN number one guideline. So we do that. Now, if we don't have a clinical trial and a patient has progressed, we do still have lomustine, which we give to patients. It's another alkylating agent. And you know that, having treated patients with lymphoma yourself. We give that to patients and they do get benefit, albeit for 4 to 6 months with lomustine. And then if they are in good functional status, we can always salvage them with Avastin in second recurrence. Or if they are not in good status, then that's where, unfortunately, you have to have discussions around hospice. But it is one of the tumors for which we've not made a lot of advances in the last two decades in terms of survival. Although the patients, if you look at SEER database, are little living 2 months longer than maybe a decade back. But that's coming from advances in surgery, advances in radiation, and overall care of the patients.
Yeah, I was going to say that it's possible the surgeons are becoming more well-versed in taking the tumor. I mean, it's, history of cancer is fascinating. a lot of times you have no advances for a long time, and then just like that, something happens and a switch and all of these new drugs. And I think brain cancers are just due for a breakthrough. And my view, Manmeet, and correct me if I'm wrong, that this breakthrough is going to somehow come from understanding the molecular characteristics of the disease. And maybe there are targets that there are drugs for, or maybe there are targets you develop drugs against. But it is very clear that these types of cancer just don't respond very well to surgery, radiation, or chemo. So we have to think outside the box. And that is what you guys need to do.
No, clearly. And I mean, I think some of the work we are doing in, even in the Precision Oncology Alliance, where you're obviously, you know, leading it, because the challenge that comes is, right, that since there are only 12 to 14,000 of glioblastoma patients, even if we identify a target, it's a, and if the number is not small, very high, small, you need a very large collaborative. And yeah, the same thing happens for if we want to understand the pathobiology of the disease or molecular characteristics of disease. A lot of people have to come together, like the TCGA effort, you know, out of NIH, or that some of the things we are trying to do out of Precision Oncology Alliance, where we are trying to understand what are the outcomes of patients with drugs, either with targeted therapies or cytotoxics when we give them. And so I think it'll take effort, but I'm hopeful that, you know, in near future, we'll have a breakthrough. We did have a ASCO plenary this year with a drug called vorasidenib, which is an IDH inhibitor in low-grade glioma. It wasn't in glioblastoma, but in low-grade glioma, we did have a IDH inhibitor, which, you know, fared favorably compared to placebo. Now, obviously, there are still more things that need to be followed for in terms of survival before that drugs become standard of care. But there is definitely hope that if there are targets and we have drugs that we develop focusing on the target, like vorasidenib for IDH inhibition, with good blood-brain barrier penetration, that we can make differences in the lives of our patients.
You know, the other thing is, I don't know, anything happening in, it's hard to believe, I mean, I know there are advances in radiation when it comes to brain metastases, stereotactic radiosurgery, all of these things. But when it comes to GBM, it is whole brain, isn't it? Or is there something changing there?
No, so we now use what we described as more focused forms of radiation, intensity modulated radiation therapy, which is more focused to where the glioblastoma is, and an area of roughly 2 centimeters or an inch around the tumor. We and then typically we have used photon-based radiation therapy, but we at our Miami Cancer Institute and several centers around the country do also have proton, which has the premise of a very less scatter and a better neurocognitive ability down the lane. But our patients, sadly, at least with glioblastoma, are not living very long to have a lot of those neurocognitive side effects. But the proton therapies have not shown survival benefits so far. What we clearly have learned with proton therapy, that it may be less immunosuppressive because radiation can lead to lymphopenia. And it's
but the reason you use protons, why? Just because like have less impact on the normal tissue, or like why would you have used protons?
Yeah, so the whole aspect is, and that's why I think protons are best for, say, kids with brain tumors, right? Because they have a much longer time frame to live. We do cure, you know, a number of patients with brain tumors in children, because they tend to be different types and sometimes more relatively more benign, and I use that term relative. But in adults, the hope is that the neurocognitive disadvantages of radiation are going to be less. So that's the driver. Now, obviously, for more widespread adoption, people would also like to see survival benefit, which we have not seen so far with proton.
Yeah, and it gets a lot of, you know, because of the expense and the cost, as you know. So maybe a couple of more questions. One is, I mean, if we're having this conversation in 5 years from now, where do you think the conversation will take us? What do you think we'll be talking about? It's part of the reason I wanted to tape this podcast is many of my listeners and viewers, they feel that it is the one type, it's almost like the pancreas cancer in outside the brain, where there's just very little progress. And they look at thoracic, they look at breast, they look at GI, and it's hard not to, obviously you get energized because you want to find that thing. But I don't know. Tell us if I'm having this conversation with you 5 years from now, what would we be talking about in your opinion? Put your futuristic hat and then I'll let you go.
Yeah, no, sure. Thanks. And I concur with you. I'm envious of my lung cancer friends, melanoma, GU cancer friends, right? Because they're having drugs which are coming out like three times a year. They have like new drugs, right? Every time you turn around, you have drugs, and a lot of these ADCs are working and the hazard ratios are like decreasing by the wayside. I think we clearly have been challenged, just like our colleagues who treat pancreatic cancer or liver cancer, where the breakthroughs have not come as frequently. But I think, you know, we just have to stick to the basics. That is, just try to understand the pathobiology of the disease better. Make sure we profile every patient with glioblastoma to identify the target and then give them targeted therapy. There are now at least ongoing trials. Pemigatinib study that I alluded to at least is looking at it at 60 centers all over the world to see if use of pemigatinib can be favorable for patients with FGFR TAC gene fusions or some mutations in that pathway. We are still hopeful about our vaccine. The survivin-based vaccine that I'm involved with has shown some benefit. We're also excited about an IDH-based vaccine being developed out of the group in Heidelberg, which has shown some exciting results early on. Vorasidenib has shown at least that there is a place for targeted therapy even in brain tumors. We've had BRAF MEK inhibition that is at least works in the V600E alteration with BRAF, even in glioblastoma and gliomas. So we are slowly chipping at the disease. And like you said, you never know where the breakthrough may come from, right? And sometimes one breakthrough happens and it helps, it just like snowballs, right? The effect then just goes into...
It is totally what happened in lung cancer.
So, you know, clearly, I mean, you know, EGFR started it, then we had more ALK inhibition, we have, you know, RET-ROS, and then we also had immunotherapy, which works for if you don't have an oncogenic-driven tumor. So I think we are hoping, because when I started, lung cancer outcomes and GBM was very comparable. 12 to 15 months, 5-year survival, 5% in both the disease. And lung cancer now is, you know, almost like 5-year survival is 20%. And some of the types like ALK is even like 50%, right? So it's like, we are just hoping that we may have those breakthroughs our lung colleagues have had, because we want to, you know, help our patients and help the community.
It is a challenging disease. I mean, when I was seeing patients, every time I covered for this disease was not only the emotional aspect and everything else, but the physical aspect of how it affects the person's ability to be dependent versus independent. There's a lot of things to unpack. So any small progress in what you are doing is going to make a huge impact, in my opinion, in people's lives.
No, I could not agree with you more. I mean, and these are the nicest people you'll take care of. Because as we said, in 99% of our patients, there is no risk factor. It's like your next door neighbor who's, you know, at the prime of their life in their 50s and 60s, and suddenly they have the most challenging diagnosis of their life. And so your heart goes out to these people and you truly want to help them.
Dr. Manmeet Ahluwalia from the Miami Cancer Institute, thank you so much for visiting me on Healthcare Unfiltered. And don't forget, you have to send me your address so we could do, as you know, the T-shirt exchange. Manmeet, thank you so much for visiting with me on Healthcare Unfiltered.
Shadi, thank you. It was such a pleasure.
Okay, folks, thank you so much for listening and thank you for being on today's podcast. I appreciate you tuning in. And thank you to my special guest, Dr. Manmeet Ahluwalia, for sharing his wisdom, his expertise, and what lies ahead for the treatment of the unfortunate patients who are diagnosed with brain tumors. Subscribe to the show, rate it, and let me know what you think by direct messaging me on Twitter at Shadi Nabhan. And if you want a t-shirt, the Healthcare Unfiltered t-shirt, you do need to ask about it, but you also need to post it on Twitter, because that's, folks, how marketing works. Subscribe to the show, and always you can watch it on my website, shadinabhan.com, or on YouTube, Shadi Nabhan and Healthcare Unfiltered. Before I let you go, I'm going to leave you with a saying by Albert Einstein. Learn from yesterday, live for today, hope for tomorrow. The important thing is not to stop questioning. Until next time, take care.